Marco.
Hello.
Marco. Sorry, I'm having an 8 p.m. coffee. You know what that means.
Good evening, everyone.
Welcome.
How is your Monday evening going, besides the 8 p.m. coffee?
Oh, it's good. It was a first day back at work without the mask mandate, so was getting used to that. I set up a new HEPA filter in my therapy room and then have my AeroNet going in there to sort of keep an eye on things. But definitely back to most people unmasked. There's a few people still wearing sort of the surgical masks, particularly in when they're in crowded rooms. But for the most part, it's gone. The masks are gone. The great part was within like 2 minutes of being at work, I heard two separate people like hack coughing, which was just wonderful. Just wonderful.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're in that interesting, actually I'll start with posting something actually, because the Alberta Medical Association came out with their statement today and I was sassing them. Where's my post about that? So my tweet was, wow, what a lackluster response, and frankly uninterested from a major association, sort of like a shrug. Meh, fuck them old people and compromised. They pretty much said, as always, follow the evidence. A, which evidence? And B, how would anyone who's not science researcher follow the evidence when they don't even know what evidence to follow, as we're seeing clearly by Joe Rogan's weekend? We know that COVID is still with us. It is a particular threat to the frail, elderly, and immunocompromised. Everyone should feel free to wear a mask or ask another individual to wear one for their protection. Tell me how an intubated elderly person's going to ask for someone to put a mask on.
It's ridiculous.
Just wondering, friends. So that was the Alberta Medical Association statement coming out today, which of course is very unimpressive. And you'd think that a medical association would recognize that ensuring safety for the most vulnerable is probably at the forefront of what they should do. Also, it's going to be really interesting to watch people continue to talk about reconciliation in Canada, where they continue to put marginalized communities at risk. So not sure how that's going to coincide, but I don't think too many people are worried about that at the moment. And then I'll share Mr. Dix's. Do you remember 10 days ago how I posted about that Dix was going to have his tour of hospitals unmasked? Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was prediction.
June 9th. And someone, I remember, because I was feeling sassy that night, someone came on and was like, it doesn't say he'll be unmasked. And I was like, okay, well, what came out? What came out today? Well, Mr. Dix sharing a tweet in the Nanaimo Regional General Hospital, in the ICU, about the expanded ICU, with a bunch of medical workers and, I don't know, white people that look like they're trying to do something important there. And guess what he's not wearing? A mask.
I don't see a mask, yeah.
Not a single mask in that photo. So to those who were sassing me about it, yeah, go sass yourself, okay? It's not that hard to know what these people are going to do.
Especially when the data on nosocomial transmissions are so high, like you're more likely to catch COVID in the hospital than out of the hospital right now.
Oh yeah, so I just posted another old thing up there. So that's the article from April 2023, which looked at that, and they were looking at the severe outcomes and showed that there was a reduced risk of death, but at the same time they were actually increasing the number of infections and vastly increased the nosocomial infections within hospitals. So that was sort of before we lifted masks, and now that we've lifted masks, you can expect that impact will again be greater. And as people have been screaming at the top of their lungs for 3 years, Hospitalization and death is not the only outcome, as we're clearly seeing with long COVID. And when we're seeing numbers of 14 to 20% of people, you know, well, yeah, great.
This week's news about COVID and its effects on the placenta and how it affects babies' development, it was also horrific. There was a BC mom that was documenting her child who has her baby who has long COVID. She says she caught it at 34 weeks. And ever since her baby was born, they've been having immune challenges and constantly chronically ill, but they're missing their milestones, their developmental milestones. And remember, we talked about this last week, Crystal, in our podcast, about the disruption and the gaps in development, the gaps in skills, because of how the SARS-CoV-2 virus affects our neurons in our brain. And I had these concerns, as my specialization is education neuroscience. So, you know, these babies' brains are developing. So now they're chronically ill. Well, lo and behold, mom was pregnant. And in vitro, the baby was infected. And now we're seeing the outcomes. This is in BC. This is not an isolated incident. We let this rip and we encourage pregnant mothers to completely unmask. Our system is not prepared or developed or ready to take this influx of children who have specific needs, and we don't have the resources for these children.
Well, the thing is, we just don't have resources at all anymore. Like, I shared on my wall sort of the Andre Picard one about, you know, emergency systems, emergency rooms and whatnot, that they are under duress, right? And we see this sort of across Canada. And it's fascinating to sort of watch the anti-vaccine movement work circles around it, right? I saw a post earlier that was talking about the excess deaths and how it must be vaccines because most people weren't dying from lung stuff like COVID would be causing them. Like, whoo, we have so much learning to do with people, right? Like, people still only think of COVID as a respiratory system, that it's droplet-based, despite so much evidence has come out. And reluctantly by, you know, Public Health Agency of Canada and the provincial health boards as well, that they've been releasing the information. And we know that they've had that information according to the Pop New Brunswick information and Chris that worked with them on the FOI out there, that they've had the information on long COVID since, you know, December of 2020. But when we think about the pregnancies, sadly, I'm not at all surprised. And this is something we've talked on and off about the last 2 years, is that not even just the baby getting infected, but because of sort of the blood-based issues when you're pregnant and the increase in the risk of clots when you're pregnant and how important that is for the, you know, placental communication in terms of getting the baby all the nutrients that it needs, that I'm not surprised, right, that they're having those issues and that we saw like an increase in stillbirths and some of those in some of the studies. So we fucked around and we're going to continue to find out. And, you know, it's sad to sort of watch these cases become more and more. And again, I just don't think we've seen much of it yet. I think that given that we just sort of fully demasked in April in BC, including hospitals, and then now in Alberta, and then, you know, last year actually pulling masks from other areas, we haven't actually gotten to the place where we're going to see the waves of people from those sorts of infections. We're still a bit out from that. So, you know, it's sort of scary to watch the outcomes of long COVID be coming out right now and know that this is nothing yet, right? And this is why I've always referred back to other sorts of diseases, is like, at no point did we stop taking mitigations for flu. At no point did we stop taking mitigations for, you know, measles. We always had the vaccine. And even in flu season, like, people were masked in the hospital if they weren't vaccinated. Like, we had all these sorts of mitigation strategies and reduction in high risk settings. And with COVID, we've completely crashed all of that, right? So we don't have a model to operate from right now. And to me, that's the scariest thing of all.
Well, absolutely. I mean, We're always just a step behind the UK, aren't we? Because we are following the UK model. We've always commented on this and how we noticed the pattern. Well, I am sad to report, I follow this account on Twitter called Hope Saxons, and they document and advocate for pandas. Have you heard about pandas, Crystal?
Oh no, what did they do to the pandas?
Oh no. Pandas is a neuropsychiatric symptom. It's from your encephalitic viral inflammation in the brain where kids act out, and there's an actual syndrome that these people are advocating for, and they're finding that there's a spike in kids having self-regulatory issues,
We already
emotional issues.
knew that COVID was smacking people in the executive functioning. So, like, that is, if we make the base assumption that the research showing that COVID can impair some executive functioning, there's no reason to think that it wouldn't operate the same in children's brains as it does in adult brains, which means that emotional or executive functioning issues in children will look like that, right? And I think of that in terms of my child with ADHD. That's issues with executive functioning. Well, what does that mean? That means emotional dysregulation. That means inattention. That means, trouble focusing. And, that's what you would expect.
Correct. And PANS or pandas is brain inflammation triggered by a viral infection. And this is what we've done to an entire generation of children. And I've been following this account that documents what they're seeing in the UK. And we're always just a tad behind. But this is coming down the pipe for Canada, right? The behavioral problems that administrators and teachers reporting seeing even in Ontario. Did you see that post about how they were saying how kids are just
Yeah,
being
I did.
completely disrespectful now,
Little
in your face,
wildlings.
no boundaries, like.
To be fair, I'll offer an alternate hypothesis because I don't want to assume things that we don't have the evidence for. But also, have you noticed how shitty people are right now? I mean, their parents are also teaching them how to be really terrible people sometimes. Just adding that on top. Just adding that on top.
Yeah, all social norms have been thrown out the window, right? And you can't blame lockdowns for this. You can blame disinhibition and an insult to the brain, right? And especially when it affects emotional regulation, right? And that's why we're seeing an uptake in like domestic violence, which we spoke about this, and we spoke about the increase in just overt violence, because people have the are lacking the ability to self-regulate right now, due to multiple brain infections from COVID, and then the recent research we are all now aware of the cell structures that clump and form plaques, or like giant cell lumps that die. I mean, yeah, it's going to affect your behavior, guys. The increase in car crashes, planes crashing. Oh my goodness, human error, right? And they're reactivating the CERN. What could go wrong? I'm sorry. That just popped in my head. They're reactivating the CERN after turning it off for 3 years, by the way.
Well, I threw up Barry Hunt's t tweet here from yesterday because it was talking about the increases in various stuff, things like car accidents, aviation near misses, hospital-acquired infections and deaths, medical errors and deaths, excess deaths, long COVID, healthcare worker shortages, hospital overcrowding, fungal bacterial viral infections. Because we did see that study as well in the past week that I saw anyway, that showed it was like a difference. I can't remember if the lower one was 13 or 19%. And with when you have COVID morbidity with those fungal infections, it increases to like almost 50%. So I just want to, and I want to say this for the people that sort of doubt things about COVID. Even if it's not COVID, why don't you want to understand what it is, right? Because you can blame vaccines. It doesn't make sense. And I put another one up there that's just behind Barry's tweet from Nick Mark MD, which goes through actually the various vaccines across time for the different diseases, and how with the introduction of the vaccines, it minimized these diseases and severe outcomes. So it's very, very, very unlikely to be vaccines. And also because we see that unvaccinated people are having a higher rate of these things as well. So we're also at the place where it's going to get confusing for people. And we talked about this before, because the vaccines we now have, minus maybe Novavax, I've seen some interesting data, they're not going to match up well with the viral DNA that's there right now, essentially, right? Because we've had so much variant drift, because we've allowed so much replication. And I've talked about this lots over the last 2 years, right? That's sort of a basic, is that the more information you give it, the more it's going to be able to adapt to that information. So it's evolving to go with all of the spread that we're having it. So that's why we're starting to talk about what could updated vaccines look like and all that stuff. But regardless, we see this great increase in excess deaths and all these other outcomes. Whether it's COVID, whether it's not, yelling at each other does not help. And like, we need to solve this. People are dying. I very much think of it as it's COVID, right? That, to me, it's the simplest fucking answer. Okay. So that doesn't seem like a big stretch to me, but I know for other people, it does seem like a stretch. So that brings me to a conversation that I wanted to have tonight, that I gave you a heads up that I wanted to have, at least on the podcast, because I know quite a few people listen to it after the fact. And, you know, the one thing I would say that we continue to not learn, or those on the left continue to not learn, is not to cannibalize each other. And that is sort of a persistent thing that happens in these groups. And it has happened across time. It's not just with COVID. I was watching a movie with a friend this weekend, and the band played on, which is from 1993. And it's about the AIDS epidemic and sort of how the policies were being made around that. And you saw fracturing at that point too, of the people that were scared and all that sort of stuff. But so this weekend, Mel, as I'm sure most people that are probably listening now and people that have been sort of following the COVID Twitter, is that a sort of well-known COVID personality posted a Twitter of himself eating outdoors with no mask on, sort of in a group photo. I'd say, I think there was like, I don't know, 8-10 people at the table, and it was sort of on a patio. There were other tables full of people. And I'm going to say, I don't think we can, and I want to say there's more coming after this, so listen the whole way through, is that I think that there's some validity in stating that we have to be honest about the actions we're actually taking. And I think, perhaps there was a way that could have been done that wasn't, that didn't cause so much infighting within the COVID community, because this is not the first time this has happened. So we've seen this with multiple sort of COVID personalities, that they will sort of post a picture in a setting where they're unmasked, and people get very upset. And then they talk about sort of the mitigation that was there, blah, 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 blah. Well, you should have that with the photo, first of all, and maybe just don't post those photos, because it's always going to be taken out of context. That's just the easiest way to put it. But that brings me to my second point, which is the humility piece. And I have been in conversations with the person involved, and I'm not going to name them on here. I don't think it's helpful. If you're involved in COVID Twitter, you already know who it is. So, I've had conversations with this person in terms of being in the same spaces and like listening to them talk about it. I have a lot of respect for the information that they've put out and the help they've tried to put with people. However, when you are choosing to be an advocate for something, when you're choosing to be an ally, you have to do that with humility. And when advocates are, you know, were there rude comments? Absolutely. I will say that there were some, and there were some inappropriate comments, absolutely. But there were also just a lot of concerned people that wanted to talk about the impact of such images and, you know, their feelings about being a compromised or vulnerable person and watching this person that they'd looked up to take this unmasked photo and put it up and feeling, you know, very left behind, right? And that's sort of the common feeling that came through. But when you double down, when you go on the offensive when you get extremely defensive and you react in that way to people trying to call you in, it's hard to move forward after that, right? And that person, as far as I'm aware, has sort of gone off their Twitter account for now, which is a loss to the COVID community in the sense of that information. A lot of the information coming out of that account was good information to be coming out for the COVID community. But it can't be that sort of you hold these values until you don't. And then when you get called on that, that you get mad at people for doing that, especially when we've seen this sort of happen before. So I think we have to understand that there can be multiple things that are happening and true at once. There are people that are going to choose to take riskier decisions and be in riskier situations because of whatever their sort of scenario is. And I agree with that. And I would say even myself, right? Like, I don't really do anything socially, but there are some instances at work where I'm in riskier situations than others. And that's part of why I don't actually do social things, is that I want to minimize sort of the chains of reaction that I cause. Plus, I don't really like people. But the thing about humility is that if you're going to do those things, then it's really critical as an advocate that you recognize the privilege that comes in making those decisions. And a lot of times, simply by recognizing that privilege, you can effectively deal with the commentary that's coming and the defensiveness that's sort of being evoked in yourself. Is sometimes you need to put that defensiveness down and sort of look around and understand why those comments are coming forward. And those comments are coming forward because there are people that have no choice in this, that can't go onto a patio and make a choice to take that risk, that can't, because it literally for them at this moment is life or death, right? They either are that immune compromised or taking care of someone that immune compromised, and that's simply not a risk that they can take without literally being worried about death in that moment. And what was not helpful, in my opinion anyway, was some of the responses that came from this person afterwards in responding to these people, in terms of, you know, there were comments made that, you know, nobody's doing this 100%. I'm not going to lie about it, like other people. And that was the kicker, right? For a lot of people, was listening to this person respond that not only had they sort of taken that choice and posted this photo, whatever, that's in whatever it is, we can deal with that. But then sort of took the point above that to look out to the COVID community and state, because I'm not doing it, obviously other people are liars about doing it. And as you can imagine, that didn't go well. And I think that's fair. But I would love to hear your thoughts, Mel.
I mean, white guys don't like getting called out on their bullshit, right? They don't like being called out when they're not walking the walk, right? And that's what people were pointing out. They're like, okay, you're seeing this and this and this, but what's going on? Like, it could have been reframed. It could have been a teaching moment. It could have been a learning moment for him personally. Aha! It could have modeled learning beyond being called out. But instead, you know, it was the emotional reaction of, I'm going to delete this count and then 80,000 followers and get flushed down the toilet, right? Like, I don't know. Is that a correct reaction? I don't know. In that moment, who knows, right? Who knows? But I mean, we also have to talk about the capacity for people to be able to make calm and valid decisions right now, too.
Well, and there's a reason that the term white fragility exists.
Correct. Right?
There's a reason that there's ways to approach this. And I think And again, I have respected this person and the information they've put out for a long time, but I don't think that I should be blocked or deleted from that sort of group because I mentioned this fragility. I think if you're a true advocate, that includes learning from other people. I think that means listening to other people. And I think that I've seen a few people make that decision to sort of, when they're having an emotional reaction, just go and like sort of get quite upset about the reaction, leave. And whether I don't think I can say there's a right or wrong here. I think that we're all humans. And that's part of why I'm having this conversation is because it's not as black and white as we always like to think that it is, but having these conversations is important. And not being willing to have these conversations because they're uncomfortable or because we have to apply these values or structures to ourselves, that we can't do that, right? We can't refuse to acknowledge where our own hypocrisy is. You can do 99 out of 100 things, and that's great. And if you don't do the one, the thing that most of us ask is that you own that, right? That you own the privilege that comes with that decision, that you own sort of the outcomes that come with that decision. And I think that's hard for people to do. I think we often lead with our emotions, especially right now. We are 3 years into this and everybody's tired, right? Like, it's exhausting to sort of perpetually feel like it's you and a small group of people against the world. But I would step out and into that and say, the whole world doesn't have to agree with you. Most of the world doesn't have to agree with you, but the truth is the truth is the truth, right? And the things that we should be doing will be the things that we should be doing. And when we fail to do those, it's not about perfection. It's about acknowledging where we make our mistakes, picking ourselves up and trying to do better when that happens. And I agree with the sentiment in some of the things that he said in the early responses to this, of sort of outlining why he felt that was an appropriate decision for him and sort of the risk analysis and all that. I would say none of that required sort of the maskless photo. In my opinion. Again, this is just in my opinion. Am I personally angry at him for doing that? No. I understand sort of we're all human right now and we're all trying to figure out how to move forward in this world. But the fact of the matter is some people don't have the privilege to move forward in this world as it is right now. If they try to move forward, that can mean their death, right? And I think the least any of us can do as advocates and as people with various forms of privilege is acknowledge that, right? Is to acknowledge that basic fact and say, like, some of us will have the ability to move forward with this in much easier ways than other people, and other people are stuck, right? There is no other way for them to ascend this sort of hierarchy of COVID activities because it's just not a risk that they can take for various reasons. And as other people are making choices, we need to acknowledge that, right? I do think that's sort of the bare minimum that we can do as allies in this. And I think that means we have to at times put down that fragility and listen, truly listen about the way it impacts people.
I've also encountered individuals that are so riled up that they are just out there looking for a fight. They're looking for that dopamine hit to engage with someone and just pick a fight, right?
Oh, I agree. And as I said, I think that there were, you know, a number of sort of inappropriate, angry, emotional responses that were delivered towards him as well. So, I mean this from sort of every piece of advocacy, is that we can't tear each other apart, but also, we have to be able to own our own mistakes, right? There's that duality there. It can't be either or. It's that we have to work together. And when we misstep, we have to be able to call each other in. And when we're not able to do that, when we are all defensive against one another, we are seeing what we are now, which is just sort of the breakdown of the community And like I said, when someone's doing 99 out of 100 things right, those are good things. We still should be able to talk about the one thing that they're not doing right and give, you know, have a conversation about that without, you know, losing members of the community. Because that's sort of what happened, right? Like, he's gone off of Twitter. That's a lot of information that's lost to many people on Twitter. Information that was really important to them. Which I think, honestly, had we just had a different conversation and had there been a bit less defensiveness, it could have gone very differently. But this is me approaching it from sort of a psychology standpoint, right? And also not thinking that there's necessarily one solution, but that we have to be working together to find the various solutions. And that's not what we're seeing right now. And I understand why people were angry too, right? Especially when they've been in situations where that's just not even on their radar of things that they would possibly be able to experience right now. And I think if we could all just do the basics of recognizing sort of the privilege that comes in these various decisions and activities, that it would dispel a lot of that sort of frustration, at least for a lot of the people.
Correct. I mean, we made it this far into the pandemic. For those of us still here, it's because we have an element of privilege that we've been able to protect ourselves thus far, right? We must acknowledge that. We must acknowledge that privilege. We're still alive because there's an element of privilege that has allowed us to be here and be able to look at this with a clear mind. Otherwise, if we didn't have the privilege that we had, then we wouldn't even have the energy to fight with people online. Because when you're sick, your focus is on getting better and on feeling better, or your family member to get better. It's not fighting online. I mean, I've also reported, Crystal, having seen coordinated attacks on the COVID community too, right? And really all it takes is finding that one issue that fires everyone up, gets their fight or flight activated. And then you have a fracture in the community, which makes us that much weaker in fighting what we need to fight, which is for disability rights, for climate change equity, right? For clean air, for inclusivity, for all those afflicted with long COVID or will be afflicted with long COVID. I mean, did you see that news? Oh, I got to send it to you. The Montreal Gazette published this piece how they're asking for a national inquiry into the Canadian ER systems and how they're failing across the board right now.
Yeah, and you know, I worry with the recent decisions across provinces to sort of lift any protection measures. It's not going to help with those situations, right? And the more we fracture as a community, the less sort of effective we can be. It's already hard enough to be effective within all of this. And I truly, and I know I have a weird brain compared to most, so lots of people when they listen to this might just think I'm totally off the rocker as I'm talking about this. And I'm sure lots of people will sort of come down on one side or the other, but the point was never sides. The point was safety for all, right? And remembering that throughout all of this is that we have to fight for the people that need it, even when it's uncomfortable for us. And I think that's hard sometimes. I think it's hard right now in the way the pandemic is, you know, to keep doing all these things and to keep positive and to keep pushing. But we need everybody who's willing to fight the fight to sort of stay on it, right? And even I'm, you know, watching the sort of outcomes of that person leaving Twitter and sort of the further fracturing that's happening because some people are, you know, making posts about how it shouldn't have happened that way. And then other people are, you know, sharing it I'm not going to say celebrating, but, you know, stating that that's what happens when you sort of do these things. I get where both sides are coming from, but it's not helpful. Right? At the end of the day, it's not. And people don't have to like me saying that, but I'm sort of the queen of saying the things that people don't like. But we have bigger fucking problems than each other.
That's what I'm saying, though. They want us to fight each other, right? Like if people would just look up off their phones for a second and see what's going on in the world, like, we have more pressing matters at hand. We currently have floods in Scotland and northern England, a Mexican heat dome with temperatures exceeding 48 degrees. The Antarctic sea ice is basically gone. There's continuing fires in Canada and Alberta and the tundra. We have a Mormon cricket invasion in Nevada, like biblical pestilence, crickets everywhere. There's a snowstorm in Alberta, in southern Alberta currently right now, in June. Early hurricane season has started in the Gulf of Mexico. An orca uprising is currently happening, where Gladys, the maternal lead of this pod, was injured by a billionaire's yacht, and she got so pissed off she taught the other orcas how to remove their rudders, and then they have communicated with each other globally, and they are removing all the billionaire's rudders off their $1 million yachts.
Go orcas! Destroying
intergenerational wealth.
Go orcas!
Orca uprising. Like, it's the orca uprising. There's like 30 of them, and gray whales.
Fuck yeah! I'm cheering them on from afar
right now.
No, but you're right. Like, right, there's all this stuff in the world going on, and again, people don't have to agree with me. They don't have to like my opinion on this, but advocacy was never supposed to be about us as individuals. It was never supposed to be about what we felt, about what was good for our family, about those things, because we're always going to have some sort of privilege that we have to look past and work towards for other people that don't have the access to the things that we do. And, you know, I hate to see the COVID sort of advocacy go the same way, where people are so caught up in what they want and what they need out of everything, whether it's on either side of this sort of debate of that picture, that they forget what the point of all this was.
I mean, but wouldn't it be exactly what those GBD bastards want? They want all these long COVID activists and COVID activists at each other's throats and to fracture our networks, because they know they are culpable as hell for what they've been responsible for in the misinformation for herd immunity.
But they also know it works, fractured. They also know it works, because this is the difference between, you know, if we look at sort of party lines, and I'll state outright, I'm partyless and more partyless by the day, is that unlike what we're seeing in the left, the right don't eat each other. They grow, right? Because they don't expect one another to have the exact same views about all the same things. And when they sort of crowdsource views about something, and part of it's because of the nonsense, right, is that they sort of will jump into anything, but they don't splinter in this way. And this is sort of the loss of the left that we always see in many sort of different areas, is that there's this expectation of sort of perfection and agreement in all views. And I would be lying if I said I don't feel that towards people, right? That I don't have expectations that if you are acting in a certain way, that you're sort of not living out your values. But that can't stop what we need to do. And that is what it is doing, right? Is we are so busy pissing on each other on Twitter that we're not actually moving forward with the advocacy that we need to do. And again, I understand the emotion behind that. I understand, you know, the anger and the righteous rage people feel when they've been doing this day in and day out for 3 years. So in no way do I expect them to sort of move past that. But for the other advocates that sort of are not in that moment of emotion, that we have to continue to do what we're doing. And if we continue to fracture, if we continue to push each other over cliffs, right, we will get nowhere.
Well, let me offer you some observations too. I'm actually seeing a repeating pattern of what the far right has learned during the Trump administration, when there was a fast movement of, remember, women marching, right? The pink hats. Remember BLM? Remember when Kavanaugh was sworn in and everyone organized? Well, somewhere along the line, from then till now, they have completely fractured from each other. All those activists start hating on each other and accusing each other. That is a completely documented GOP op, actually. And they actually have taken those same tactics and have now applied it to the COVID community. Oh, guess what? Guess who's behind the GBD? Yes, that's correct, the GOP. So this is what I mean. They have learned their tactics, learned those tactics in breaking up, you know, people trying to organize. And
it's fucking effective.
Because, well, if you acknowledge it and if you study it, then you should be able to reverse engineer that shit and understand how they're doing it. Because I see the pattern. Does anyone else see the pattern? Remember when they were calling all the BLM and really they were just fighting fascism when all the Proud Boys were gathering, and which is now we know it's like they had the J6 hearing. We know that it's a link to Russia. Well, remember when they were calling them terrorists and extremists? Do you remember them calling us COVID zero zealots too? Right? The radicalism and the assignment of othering is a repeat pattern in how they fracture communities from organizing. We see this happening across the board in every single country that has had some sort of Trumpian figure in this in the country. And now we've got, you know, Pierre Poutine, right?
Oh, absolutely right. It's the same walk that we're doing, and people are surprised at the strength of that movement within Canada, but we're not, because, well, we've been talking about it for a few years, about this sort of being the follow-up to it, right? That we follow the pendulum swing. And yeah, this is why I sort of started this conversation about sort of talking about privilege and owning our own privilege and having humility, because I don't think that we're going to get out of this without people fumbling along the way. And some fumbles are very big and some fumbles are not so big. But the sort of basic thing we can do as allies and advocates is own those mistakes when we make them, is have humility about what our actions or our perspective, how that differs from other people, and truly working to understand that. And I say this having done this myself, right? That I have made mistakes. I have been publicly called out on Twitter before, like by people that are still sort of followers of mine, because when somebody calls me out, I look at it and usually the first thing I say to myself is, this is not actually about me, right? That this is someone trying to explain to me their perspective of how they're seeing something I've said or something I've done. And I cannot have all the experiences in the world to understand everything from every perspective. I've not lived every life. I've not experienced every marginalized identity. So taking the time to actually reflect on those things instead of getting defensive is always my first step, right? And then I go back to that comment usually, or that person, either I usually try to address it publicly, because I think that's the best way to do so. And then state, like, what did I learn from that, right? How is that a teachable moment for me? And that often diffuses that entire sort of blow up that happens. The problem is that when that doesn't happen, then it builds, right? And then we see sort of the growth of the anger that happened, because the more that someone denies the impact that they've had, even if that wasn't their intent. And again, this is why I brought up sort of white fragility at the beginning, is because a lot of times when you're talking about sort of the isms, right, is that it's not about your intent. It's about the impact of those things. And when you continuously try to say, like, that wasn't my intent, that wasn't my intent, that wasn't my intent, no, that's not what I meant, it stokes the anger in those people instead of diffusing it, because they see you as completely missing their perspective and what where they're coming from. Whereas if you look at, you know, what was the impact of what I did, even if I don't necessarily understand it, even if I don't necessarily agree, can I understand in a way that I can express to that person that I've learned something from that interaction? And is that hard? Yeah. I mean, of course, this is hard. If anyone thinks that we're 3 years into this and these conversations are going to be fucking easy, I mean, come on, guys. Like, this is hard. We are in a very trying situation. Everybody's emotional. People have lost people. People are dying still. Like, this is not going to be shits and giggles, right? That's not the life of advocacy. You have to be ready for challenging conversations. And we have to, you know, strengthen our resolve a bit to be willing to move through the discomfort of those conversations, to move through the discomfort of learning from other people things that we don't know, so that we can move forward and move forward with a more robust understanding and perspective of what this situation is. Because that is where the humility is. I cannot know everything. I cannot know how every action or word or thing I've used impacts other people. And when someone tells me about the impact of something on them, the least I can do is sort of acknowledge that.
You're approaching this with a growth mindset, right? You're very aware. You're very aware of your intentions, your thought processes. I mean, remember that study that said 50% of people don't even have an internal monologue?
Shit, Mel. That shit still terrifies me. What's going on in there, y'all? Like, is it just empty? Is it just, you know, like, I can't turn this brain off. I got 27 browsers going on. But you're right.
It's quiet in there. It sounds nice. Can I go in there?
Fuck, I want a nap. Can I just crawl in there? But you're right. And I'm trying to say this with humility, is that I recognize I have a weird brain, and that it's not just the discomfort that actually induces sort of these things and this growth and this movement forward. It's self-awareness and the willingness to be uncomfortable that then breeds excellence in areas, right? Because you have to be self-aware enough to examine your own intentions, your own experiences from an observer lens, so that you can then build the other perspectives into that. And that's where the discomfort comes in, right? And when you can hold those two things, when you can hold yourself respectfully, but also acknowledge that you are one piece in this whole thing, you can move forward, and you can move forward with growth. But it's very challenging, right? That's a challenging thing for people to do. And self-awareness is not humanity's strong feature.
No, that's why Buddha says life is all suffering. Mindfulness requires metacognition. Metacognition requires higher cognitive functioning. And when you are constantly stressed, worried about where you're going to live, what you're going to eat, if your kids are constantly sick, if you're going to be okay, are you going to lose your job from taking so many sick days off because your kid's sick all the damn time? Like, there's not much time reserved for higher critical thinking and reflection and mindfulness. Let's be honest, right? Like, the reason why people don't live with the growth mindset unless they're fully aware of it is because they are caught up in fight or flight mode and just trying to survive.
Capitalism. The joy of capitalism, right? And I'll speak to this personally, right? Is that, like, my, you know, emotional growth and development, cognitive growth and development, was I always smart as a kid? Yep. Did I do really good in university? Yep. I probably didn't start actually becoming significantly self-aware to the point that I could reflect on these things till I was 30 years old, right? And that was because I had gotten good enough at coping with stress at that point, that things had slowed down enough at that point that I actually had the awareness, the time, the privilege to sort of engage in that self-awareness. And that is a privilege. That is a privilege because, you know, when I was 16 and being a single teen parent, like, I couldn't do those things. I just didn't have the time, let alone the sort of energy to engaging in that. So it's challenging and it requires a bunch of circumstances, but also a large piece of the population, they turn away from change, right? They turn away from growth. And I'm not saying that to sort of make people feel depressed about this, but when we think about the normal curve, right, just think statistically, when we think about the levels of growth people are going to have, like 80% of the population is going to fall in that middle big chunk of the curve. And they're like not that inclined to change. Whereas we're going to have this sort of top peak of people, 10%, right, that really fall into that. And then bottom 10% that like really will refuse, right? And most people are going to be in that middle bit. And we're sort of seeing that through these repeated COVID fracturings that we see is because this is a pattern, right? We've seen this with actually multiple sort of public prominent figures in the COVID community in the last 2 years on Twitter, is that this sort of comes like a picture is posted, rage sets in, they like go off for a week and then they come back. This has been sort of a repeated pattern. But we haven't learned. This is the thing, is that the pattern is still being repeated even amongst everybody in the advocacy groups, because the emotion of it all, because it's hard to be self-aware right now. It's hard to challenge ourselves in those ways. And putting the sort of burden of labor on the people that are suffering the most is it's a challenging, if not sort of ridiculous thing to expect right now of those people. So that's why I try to hold those of us who, you know, are in more privileged positions, have more time, have more freedoms, you know, have these bigger followings, that I do sort of have sometimes higher expectations of us to, you know, be careful with our words, be careful with our thoughts. Does that mean that I don't sort of say fuck at someone sometimes? I do. I get emotional too. Yeah, definitely did that today. But we have to like keep trying. We can't just give up as soon as we get uncomfortable, sort of with the feedback, as soon as we get uncomfortable with sort of the next stage that comes, is that we have to be trying to grow through this. And through that, I hope that we can actually make the change that we want to make. But we have to be ready that is not just going to be challenging in the sense of, you know, professionally or sort of social media wise, but that's going to be personally challenging too, right? To personally take that sort of growth mindset on, you have to be willing to do something with that.
Absolutely. And I just posted this visualization here, and this is Maslow's hierarchy. It's self-actualization, which is really human development, right? You see all the layers, the base layers of the physiological, your food, your water, your sleep, homeostasis. People who are suffering from long COVID and suffering from homeostasis disorders and dysfunction, they're only barely surviving at the base level. So they're not going to get into deep critical thinking of morality, creativity, problem solving, lack of prejudice even, which is at the top of the pyramid here, right? And then the next level is that safety, right? With security of body, employment, resources, morality, mortality, your family, right? This is when you're thinking worried about your kids being sick all the time, or your finances, or, oh my God, I'm going to lose my security. That's still at the second base level of development, really, and being able to move on. And then
it's sort of a privilege triangle to be
honest, right? Because then up in there is love and belonging, esteem and self-actualization. I mean, how many people are really reaching self-actualization, right? Like, I don't know, right? But it is a privilege, not only is a privilege triangle, but really this is how our society has been structured to function, right? Those at a certain level only get to reach the green or the purple because they have the resources to do that. If you are disabled, you're chronically ill, you're stuck at the base level for homeostasis, right? And that's probably why there's so much infighting and also, we haven't gotten to the point where we can really critically think and organize properly because we're stuck in survival mode. Our fight and flight is activated. Robert Sapowski writes this great novel called When Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And it talks about all the way things that sustained cortical hormones and cortisone hormones from your stress hormones will affect you. I mean, we all know stress makes you sick. I mean, but now pair this with a pandemic. I mean, you talk about immune dysregulation, but you also have homeostasis dysregulation.
Yeah, and that's sort of, where I brought that idea in, right, of the privilege that comes with sort of being in some of these positions that we do think about that, right? And we name that privilege and, the fact that part of my day or my learning is being able to have these conversations with you and to talk with people, that's a privilege because some people are out there working three jobs right now, trying to get by in the current economic situation that we're at, trying to manage the exposure of all those jobs. And that's part of the decisions that they're making. And that's also why I've focused so much throughout the pandemic on the systems versus the individual, is that even knowledge translation and knowledge uptake is a privilege, right? Like being able to have these conversations and share the research and all those things. It comes with a certain level of, awareness that we've built over time, and not everybody has access to that. And if we do choose to be in a position where we are acting in somewhat leadership and sort of become a figure for people in these things, then I just think we have to remember that humility and that privilege and be able to name it and sort of have those conversations. Because when we can't, we do see sort of what we've been seeing across time with the COVID community, where it simply fractures and we lose good sources of information, where we don't have to, because we're angry, agreeably so, and righteously for many people. But also that we can't sort of minimize our defensiveness about these things. I'm not going to get everything right, right? That's just a fact. I'm going to get some shit wrong, in the way I speak, in the things I do, but that doesn't mean I give up, right? That doesn't mean that I stop thinking that these things are important, or when I'm sort of at the safety level that I want to be at, that I stop working towards the safety for those that still need it. That's where the community care is, right? Is we have to remember that at the foot of this, the foundation of all of this should be community care, not self-safety. And I think sometimes we get that wrong in our communities. And again, people may be upset at me for saying that, but we can absolutely want to keep our own family safe and everybody around us safe that we care about, but we have to actually do that for the people we don't care about as much too.
Yeah, you can't pick and choose who you want to live and die. Sorry.
Well, and if you do make choices that can impact other people, to recognize that, right? That again, I think that's the bare minimum that can be asked of us in these communities, is that, if we do things, that we talk about it openly, but with humility. It's like, I am taking the first airplane that I've taken in 5 years in a few days. I'm very concerned, getting very packed up with sort of, my air filter that's coming with me, and all of my proper respirators and all this stuff. But I know that it's a risk. So I'm also mitigating that risk in various ways, both before and after. I don't do social things for many reasons, including not to sort of have those chains of transmission. And I will do everything I can, but can I say that it's not a risk? No, I cannot. No, I cannot. And for some people, that will be too much risk. For me, it's sort of a risk made in the context of my career and my finances and like all these things that I have to keep going based on my personal situation. But I certainly cannot negate the risk that it takes or not own the things that I need to do to make that as safe as possible in order to take that action. And I think that is living with it. I think that is being a leader in this area, is not to sort of ignore the things that we need to do, but to fully own them. And then to recognize the privilege that's coming with being able to even do this because I can take those mitigation measures, because I have access to respirators and HEPA filters and all those things that many people out there don't have access to right now, that I even have the opportunity to do that, right? And knowing that it will be a risk, not being around compromised people, making sure everybody knows in terms of my clientele, like that I've traveled recently, that I've been to a conference, I have N95s in my sort of therapy room ready to go. If anybody doesn't happen to have a mask, like to minimize the impact and the ripple effects of the choice that I make by owning it openly, by explaining exactly what steps I've taken to mitigate that risk and where the risk still lies, right? It's a hard world right now.
It is. And, you know, it made me think of that post Tamara Taggart posted about Sophie and her not being able to go to her year-end water park field trip because they didn't make it inclusive enough for a kid with disabilities. Like, you either all go or none of you go to the water park if there's no one that wants to go with her. Like, come on, guys. Like, this is field trip planning 101. Like, we know this, what is going on, but it's just this modeled ableism, right? It's so ingrained. Like, I don't even think some of these people are aware that they're being ableist.
No, but this comes down to even the post that I made earlier, right, by the American Medical Association. You know, their framing and their statement of things like, it's a particular threat to the frail, elderly, and immunocompromised. Well, inherently in that statement, inherently by lifting the mask mandate and making that statement, you're pretty much saying we're okay with those losses, right? That those are acceptable losses. And that is the statement that has been fed to our population at large. And we are reaping the benefits of that now because large parts of the population now, those are the words that come from their mouth, right? Right.
And it also gave them a false sense of security, thinking that they're invincible because they're not frail. They're not sick, right? It's a brilliant psyop, like, seriously, right?
You're not disabled until you're disabled.
Right. They were never informed. Like, no, it has not been clear yet that, you know, even if you have no pre-existing conditions, you can still develop long COVID. No one's talked about that.
Well, and even in discussion, you know, risks of reinfections and those things, it's like everyone speaks about it as if you just start from baseline each time, right? As if there's no sort of compounding effect if you get multiple reinfections within a short period of time. And the issue to me it doesn't actually matter the numbers of it. It's that we simply deny these things as a whole right now. It's like we haven't even gotten to the place where we can talk about, you know, the prevalence of it and deal with those things, because there's just not even acceptance of the basic stuff right now. And we see that in the lacking of the understanding of COVID is airborne, right? And the lacking of sort of the ventilation changes that we've needed in masks in hospitals. Like, I will die on this hill. Why the fuck did we ever take masks out of hospitals? In general, not just with COVID. Not just for COVID, right? For the decline in flu, in RSV, in airborne-based diseases that we saw across long-term care and acute settings such as hospitals, why would we stop that benefit? Because we don't care if the frail, the elderly, and the immunocompromised are the price, because we don't feel like wearing masks. That's what the sentiment is right now. And that's the sentiment I've heard from people, right? I've had these conversations with people, you know, where I'm like, yo, man, I've read like 400 systematic reviews at this point. I could summarize some of them for you. I could send some of them to you. And they acknowledge they haven't read the research. They don't know the background, but they don't feel like wearing masks.
Can I remind everyone that there is no treatment for long COVID right now, let alone ME-CFS? And I've lived with ME-CFS chronic pain and fibromyalgia since 2009, right? And there is no treatment except for, okay, I go monthly to see my specialist and I get lidocaine injections, actually 14 from the base of my skull to my tailbone. And that's how I manage my pain. But literally, that's if you get a specialist, if you get to that point. That's if you have a family doctor, if you can get one, right? And that's if you make it, you know, into the 3.5 wait list for any specialists right now in Canada. It's a long road for people who have gotten infected and have allowed themselves to be infected or have gotten infected just because they didn't know. It's horrific, really.
And again, even if we sort of zoom out from just COVID and the long COVID that will come, our healthcare systems are collapsing, right? And people yell at me when I say that, what's collapsing? There's still hospitals. And I'm like, well, we've got at least four emergency departments in BC that closed for half the days, right? They're closed overnights. They used to be open overnights and now they're closed. We have Adrian Dix, who is going and sort of talking about opening new ICU beds. We can't staff the beds we have right now, right? We are not sort of changing the structure of training or the funding that we provide to these places to make it so that we can have adequate staffing. So even if, I don't know, 10% of people that have had COVID get long COVID, and let's remember the policy was mass infection. So when we're reporting 80 to 90% of people have had COVID, that's a lot of people. That's going to add up in terms of even if it's not recurrent. So let's even just take the base amount, right? That first infection only gives long COVID, and let's ignore the reinfections, which is not accurate. But even at that 10% of most of the population, how are their healthcare needs going to be met in our current system for 1 year, for 5 years, while we figure out how to even treat long COVID, what it means, what the full symptom profile is? How are we going to manage that for the next 5 to 10 years? I don't know. Because there is no comprehensive plan right now. And in fact, we're taking steps like getting rid of basic protection measures in hospital, which could at least alleviate some of that. Right. And it's worrying, right? For not just COVID, but for the entire country, for people that are trying to get needed care, that these wait lists are not going to get shorter, right? The waits for these specialized treatments and specialists and oncologists and neurologists, they're not going to get shorter as more people are seeing the outcomes of long COVID. This is only going to grow.
Did you see how many people in BC have to go to Bellingham to go across the border to like get their cancer treatment?
Well, and like we saw that article a couple weeks ago of like running out of the drugs, right, for some of the cancer treatments, and we've seen that with antibiotics. And this is what I mean, is like we had years, right, to sort of upscale these things. At the very least, we could have done, if we were going to mass infect everybody and cause these outcomes, we could have upscaled sort of our medications, our healthcare systems to deal with the influx. But we didn't even do that. So what about when we have no antibiotics or antibiotics that work?
It's not just antibiotics that they ran out of. It was the oral suspension antibiotics. Oral suspension and antibiotics is usually for children.
Yes.
Because they can't swallow pills. That's what we're running out of. It's
well, because we saw the mass increase in strep.
The strep like wave has really depleted the antibiotic stockpile, which should be a concern.
Right. And it's not that we don't have sort of the funds, right? There's enough funds that exist in the world. But capitalism, it's not really monetary making for them at this moment. I mean, I'm sure it will be eventually when we sort of are really at the crunch periods, and then we're going to see sort of the overpricing of the medications, and people are just going to be stratified even more by what they can access. And we will see just more stratification of the healthcare system. And that's sad, right? It's just sad, like that so many of these things would be addressable. And again, if you even if you just sort of take COVID out of the equation, the healthcare system is in terrible strife. Like, it needs funding. We need to be working on these things, but we don't. And that in itself is causing all this secondary harm to people. Right? People are going undiagnosed with issues. We already know that, you know, a sizable portion of the population lives with sort of risk factors that they're unaware of yet, like cardiac risk factors, all those sorts of things. We're not the healthiest population. So even if we zoom out of COVID, which is pretty hard to zoom out of because the impact it's having, we are sort of, man, we're taking ourselves down at the knees, right? We're just chopping ourselves down in terms of the resources that we have. And even if the anti-vaccine movement, the raw water people, sewage people, you know, so I call them, and drink sewage soon. Even if those people don't love the vaccines, don't love sort of what we're doing, they sure do show up at the hospital when they're dying and sick. Right? They don't show up at Joe Rogan's doorstep. They don't show up at Elon Musk's doorstep. They show up at the hospital still. And we won't be able to handle that burden forever. And guess what that means? We're going to be back in that place of care is stratified. And it breaks my heart to think that people that have made choices that have actively harmed themselves or others will be placed in priority over people who've tried their best to stay safe throughout this. But it's, and do I think, I make no claims about what is the ethical thing to do in that. I think we've run into that question a lot, but just as like a human, that hits me in the feels, right? That we'll come back to those decisions and someone like my grandfather, because he's older, because he has pre-existing health conditions, that he may be left to die in the hospital to care for someone younger who put themselves in harm's way.
I was just remembering all the stories that were coming out of the UK during that first horrific wave that hit them, and how like this like 92-year-old woman on a ventilator gave up her purse for like a younger patient that had come in. And it's like stories like that are like seared into my memory bank. Like I can never get rid of it, right?
Well, and like, when did we decide that people of a certain age don't matter?
That's
And
right.
I've said this 2 years in a row now, when Remembrance Day came around, is how the fuck do you have that day, take that holiday, and say you care about that population when we're actively letting them die around us? When we're saying that their lives don't matter? When we're saying that we will prioritize our convenience and our comfort over their lives? Because that's what we're doing, right? That's what the American Medical Association's posts are doing, is saying, you know, the frail and the elderly and the immunocompromised are at more risk for bad outcomes, but we will still take masks off in our hospitals because people don't like to wear them. That's absurd. It's absurd.
So that really just captures how selfish this generation is, really, right? I mean, they've completely allowed the pandemic to persist because wearing a mask and not being able to do brunch was too inconvenient for them. So now suffer the little children.
Well, and you know, we've seen sort of things slowly be taken away. And it's like lots of us aren't doing lots of those things, right? And I'm like, You want your movie theater? Go ahead. You want your brunch? Go ahead. You want your mall? Go ahead. But the hospitals? Really? Long-term care? Really? That's where you needed to take this fight? That's how little we needed to sort of care about those populations, that we needed to go all the way to this? Like, how, as a society, will we be able to look ourselves in the eyes after this? I just, the lack of value that we've placed on these individual lives is tragic, you know? And we know what the outcomes will be. Again, I included the sort of April 2023 paper that we know that the hospital infections are rising with all these choices, right? And to let them rise and to say, well, it's the frail and the elderly and the immunocompromised. Who the fuck do you think needs the hospital? Who the fuck do you think needs those treatments?
But yeah, they're crashing our national hospitals, our public Canadian healthcare system. It is being destroyed right now before our very eyes. And all we have to do as citizens is freaking put on a respirator, shout with our voices, and ask for clean air. That's all we have to do to save our hospitals, you guys. Have you figured this out yet? Our hospitals are being destroyed. Our resources of being able to stay alive and not declare bankruptcy because we had a jammer, you know, from having too much poutine. Like, you don't want to have to declare bankruptcy, lose your home because healthcare went private. Come on, everyone. Like, you do understand this is all interlinked, right? Hi, Sunshinies. Nice to see you. Hi, Jacqueline. Hi, Joy. Hi, everyone. But, like, no, this is all interlinked, all right? They're pushing. People like Bonnie Henry's camp are pushing for privatization of everything, from education, which is under attack, to our healthcare system, which is under attack. And it's being brought down by the same thing, which is our inability to control infecting each other with a BSL-3 virus that really was handled the first time SARS-1 came around. We dealt with it as a nation by putting on N95s for 3 weeks, and it was dealt with. It didn't drag on for this long.
And this will not be the last pandemic. We will probably get hit by the next one while this one is still fucking going on at this point. And the idea that only healthy people are going to go to the hospital, I mean, it's insanity. The point that we're at is insanity. And, you know, the Alberta Medical Association, in part of their response, was like, sick people stay home. Y'all, no, that is not what is happening. I work in community health. I work at the hospitals. I was at a meeting last week, probably 30 people, 40 people in the room. I was the only respirator. I think three other surgical masks and the rest people unmasked. Well, three of those people unmasked were coughing in the middle of that meeting. Sick people are not staying home because the workloads on these workers right now is never ending. They get pressured to not take that sick time. They show up because they need the money. They show up because they don't understand that they're not, that they might be sick with COVID. Nobody's testing. This, you know, banking on sort of hopes and dreams that sick people stay home, that's not what is happening, and they know that, right? So that inherently is going to just lead to these further infections. And now with those masks lifted, you know, I'm sad for what's to come in the hospitals in Alberta, because we've already seen it in BC. Right, we've seen it and tracked it myself since April, right? Since they lifted mask mandates, their COVID outbreak after COVID outbreak, they've simply shortened the reporting periods now and end the outbreaks after a week. And God knows they just stopped testing, and then the outbreaks disappear again, but they come back. And it's what we're going to see here in Alberta as well, right? And we already have ER departments closing. And again, I would sort of put out to the people out there, both whether you are thinking it's COVID or not, you still show up at the hospital when you're ill. So we all need to be acting towards this. And wearing a mask is not that hard, right? Are there people where it is challenging and there's reasons? Yes, sure. There's exceptions to most things that we talk about. But that's not the exception that most people are wanting. They are straight up telling me that they just don't like wearing masks. And I will say what I said in a conversation with my coworker about this is like, I don't give a fuck what your feelings are. I care about that the vulnerable are safe. Since when does it matter? Right? Are we going to stop? I guess, we don't really care about seatbelts anymore. We don't need car seats anymore. Who cares about drunk drivers?
But that's not the Canadian way. I mean, we're Canadian because we care, right? Like, that's the whole thing. We actually care. And I would even dare say it's Canadian to wear a respirator and stop the train of transmission. I would even dare say it's Canadian to support our public education.
That could be the title of this podcast. Be a Canadian.
Be a Canadian.
Wear a mask.
Wear a mask. Care. Give a shit about what's going on in your community. And maybe you can save your local hospitals. Even engage your MPs. Engage your MLAs. We have to use this democracy while we still have it. Before society collapses. And I'm not saying this to be hyperbolic. Guys.
No, but I think that we've talked about this enough, right? Is that the sort of exceptionalism that as a community we've sort of had towards ourselves and as Canadians has meant that so many people have walked blindly into watching what we already watched in the United States happen here, right? Is that we're watching those same moves be made and we're falling to the same things. You know, whether that's what's happening with Mr. PP or whether that's, you know, the decisions that are being made among our own COVID groups and the cannibalizing that happens on the left, like we're falling to those same strategies that they've used already. And we have to learn from it, right? We have to learn from it. And that starts with frickin' humility. That's always where I'm going to come back, is just being able to have the conversation and like listen to those to viewpoints and understand where others in our own community are coming from, because we don't all have the same goals, we don't all have the same privilege, but we sure as hell can listen to one another about what that means for one another. And I think we have to do that if we're going to make any sort of movement forward, because we just keep collapsing at the foundation because we eat each other. Nom nom.
But in the end, aren't we all in the end doing this for our damn kids? Like, we want them to exist in a world where they don't have to be chronically ill. We want them to exist in a world where giraffes are not going to be extinct.
Want my son to live in the world like I lived in, which was not that long ago, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, where I had an asthma attack and I went to the hospital and I got into a bed right away. And they got me on steroids right away and oxygen. And those people knew who I was and there was a plan for me.
Yeah,
son would be waiting in the hospital right now for 8 to 10 hours.
Today it was 12 hours at 2 p.m. at BC Children's. 12 hours. Like, this is not how our Canadian medical system should be. We deserve a better world. We deserve better medical care. And it starts with us by educating and caring for each other, right? We need to take a stand and protect what we have before we lose it all. Because guess what? Once we lose our public healthcare system, we're never going to get it back. The gaps that are going to fill it are going to be private, and they're going to squeeze us for everything we've got.
And it is already happening, and we know that. You know, we've seen it in BC with certain types of surgeries. I sure as hell see it in Alberta with the way AHS is going, right? Like, again, I don't speak too much about my job here, but I can definitely say that, you know, there's movement to be, you know, keeping the more complex clients, the more heavy duty clients in public care, and moving the less intense, less complex clients out to potentially private care. That will lead to even more burnout among our staff, right? And that also means that we're going to be under resourced in the public system for the most complex clients. They're going to get not the level of care that they need. And that is not where we need to be moving, but that is clearly where they're pushing it. And with the UCP government, like, that's only going to increase. So we have to speak out. We have to be cohesive. We have to understand what we want to move towards, because we are at a very big precipice at the moment, right? And we are sort of falling off these things. And again, this is where the exceptionalism comes in, of when people think it really can't happen to us, or like, we're always going to have, you know, public health care. We have doctors, we have all this stuff. Yeah, that's what the other places thought too, until they didn't. Right? And we have something until we don't. Like, we have such a hard time as a society picturing things failing if we've never experienced it before. And I think that's part of this right now, is that society as it is right now, we have like a generation or two of people we've watched sort of horrifying things in the world, but we haven't experienced them in the sense of having, you know, most of our population hasn't experienced war. They haven't experienced life before vaccines. They haven't experienced sort of the mass destruction that happens in other continents and other countries still. And we've sort of become very entitled, very exceptional towards us, that because we've had access to these things that we will always. And that is simply not the case, right? That is not the case. And things do fail, and societies do collapse, and each one of them thought that they weren't going to, right? They thought that that wouldn't be the end point for them. And just because we think that we're special and that we'll get through it doesn't mean that we will.
Have you ever watched the Michael Moore documentary, Sicko? And it's about the American private healthcare system. And this is why I understand their system so much.
I'm terrified of the American system.
You need to watch this documentary. We can group watch this, yo. There's one part where this guy accidentally saws off three of his fingers, but his copay and his insurance will only cover two fingers. So he has to choose which finger he's going to have to live without.
And listen, you know, the insurance companies used to give the quotes to you from surgeries and stuff. They don't do that as much anymore in Canada now, probably because they like to ignore that there's actually a cost associated with it. But we got the sort of insurance information when my dad had his brain surgery. He developed a brain tumor, medulloblastoma, which is near the cerebellum, and he needed to have brain surgery to remove it. The cost to the insurance company just for that surgery was like $105,000, right? We wouldn't have had $105,000 cash lying around, right? That was just the basic existence of the Canadian public health system that saved my dad's life. He had 4 weeks to live when they found that tumor. And that is where we will find ourselves if it continues on this way. And we will be making decisions about our children, about our families, that we should never be in. And those with the least amount of privilege will be the first to pay that cost. And that is why I sort of throughout this talk tonight have said, like, advocacy cannot just be about us and our own needs, right? We have to recognize where our privilege comes from, what privilege we can utilize to bolster the movement, have humility about that privilege, and just continue to use the fuck out of it to actually get somewhere with these things, because not everybody has that privilege. And goddamn if I won't die going down doing this. I would rather do that than sit back and watch it happen.
It's going to be okay, guys.
Sorry, got a little dark there. You know what? But I'm not going to be sorry, because it's fucking dark.
It is dark. We're here to warn you of the impending future, and you need to listen, because we've been trying to warn you for 3 years.
And collapse, I've said this so many times on here, collapse doesn't happen overnight. We are in it, right? We are in it. This shit is slow, it's insidious, it's every comment, it's every movement, it is a plan, it is a pathway that we are being taken down, and we have to recognize that to actually fight against it. We cannot keep thinking that things are just happening. They're not. This is a playbook, right? This has happened time and time again.
Yes. It's a pattern. It's a playbook. It's the same players across the border on both sides. If you've been paying attention, there's a plan. Okay, this is a destruction. They're trying to destabilize our democracy. As Sunshiny had written this brilliant, brilliant thread. Here, I'll just let her explain it. Can I add her? I'm going to add her.
Yes. I'm hoping we can keep it relatively short, though, because I got to go to bed soon.
Sorry. Hello? Oh, there she is.
Hello.
Hello, how are you, friend?
I'm good. How are you?
We're okay. We're just about, you know, done, you know, boil and boil. Cauldron bubble. We're ready to predict and tell you our doom is coming.
Well, you know, I hate to add to all the negativity, but I sent you a DM. And I thought, well, I might as well try and say it instead of just send it to you. We need to think bigger. We have to move beyond like narrower issues like healthcare, which I know is a huge issue, but you have to look at the much bigger picture. You have to put them into perspective by viewing through the broader context. Healthcare is one institution being destroyed. So we have to recognize they're after all of those institutions. Education, election interference, lack of commitment to rule of law, economic instability, all of them. They're all the same cause, all the same people. And this is the same thing that is happening in every other Western democracy, and it's also how the Nazis took over Germany. So that's not, you know, happy news, but that's true. Like, you guys are doing a great job informing everybody about healthcare, but we need to start reaching out to other people from other areas and start building a coalition, because if we don't, everything will fall apart. And this is stuff we have never seen in our lifetime. And nobody that ever grew up in Canada has ever seen this in our lifetime, except Indigenous communities. That's what we need to remember, is that Indigenous people have been through this. We had our own healthcare, education, economy, everything, and we watched everything just get swoop and taken out. Cut off at the knees, and kaboom, it was gone. And that's how fast it happens. And then you're standing around stunned, trying to figure out how you're going to survive. And it took 100 years for people to get back up on their feet. So this is not something that we can just sit back and go, oh, this is about healthcare. It's about a much bigger picture. You've got people that are bowling over all of our institutions that are democratic and destroying them from the outside and from the inside. So I know a few people that are medical practitioners, so physicians, nurses, that kind of thing. And I can't get over how many people on the inside are dismantling things internally. So, I mean, you've got the head of your AHS, you know, saying, okay, we're going to get rid of masks. I mean, what does that do? It's insane. So, like, you've got the people that are destroying things on the inside. So, this is really, really bad. And I think people are just in shock because of the election and all the other shit that's going on out there, that they don't recognize this is go time. We need to get organized. And if we don't, everything is going to fall apart and it won't be long. So we have had the demoralization stage where people have felt bad. And now there's all these people who have learned helplessness and apathy, and they just don't want to even pay attention to politics anymore because it's so awful and ugly. And now we're into the destabilization stage. That's what they're doing. I mean, today, we can witness it today. You saw how the news organizations, the media, spread a false rumor about Trudeau being investigated by the RCMP. The RCMP did nothing until later on in the day after people had voted already and then clarified, oh no, we're not doing that. We're not investigating them. This is sabotage. It is they're trying to rip things apart at the seams. They're trying to cause a crisis because that's the stage that comes after destabilization. Once there's a crisis, which would be removal of Trudeau, whether that be through assassination or an election, a forced election or whatever, then they would just install someone like Polyev, and all of these policies that we're talking about in healthcare and every other institution that we have that's democratic would just flip, and then it would be moving into normalization where they'd go, oh no, that it was always like this. This is always the way that it's been. And that's how it goes, because that's the course that we are on. So we can't just sit and talk about just healthcare. We have to look at the much bigger picture. So that's what I have to say.
Thank you so much for sharing that wisdom with us. And you're absolutely correct. I mean, what we see going on here is absolutely happening also on the other side of the border. And if people who want to take away women's rights and the advancement of women's rights and our right to our own bodies, they're talking about, weren't they having like some sort of debate about abortion in Canada now? Like, they're literally trying to bring what they did down in South after the Kavanaugh, you know, oh my God, incident. Like, they're trying to bring it up here. It's a pattern. It is a playbook. Absolutely.
Yeah, I want to thank you for those thoughts, Sunshiny. I think you're right on point in terms of it's not just healthcare. It's sort of across everything right now. And I think, again, we've talked about this before. It's why some of us reacted so strongly to sort of the Trump presidency is watching the things that were going to come down the line in terms of the pendulum of Canada as well. We're right in that swing. And it is going to take a lot of work and a lot of organization to get us out of that. And I think that we are capable of that, but we have to be very direct about it and start focusing on sort of the patterns of that wide scale playbook that is being used and taking apart those things that happen. And I would, you know, advise anybody in here who hasn't sort of looked at Sunshiny's posts before to go take a look, because there's lots of analyses with regards to these things and sort of taking apart the plays that they are actively utilizing, because none of this is surprising and none of this is unknown and none of this is something that we couldn't have expected based on previous actions and previous playbooks that were used in similar ways. And a lot of people get angry when that comparison to sort of Nazi Germany is made. But the point of knowing that, the point of history is to learn and not fall to those same things. And we cannot allow that to happen here. And we are not exceptional in the sense that it can't happen here. We have to stop it from happening here. Mel, I don't know if you have any final thoughts, but I'm starting to lose my voice and I got to go to work in the morning, so I'm getting a little tired. But I want to thank everybody who came out tonight. It's been a really good conversation, a challenging one. I know that sort of listening back to this, some people will be on one side or the other of some of the things I commented on earlier, particularly with sort of the COVID cannibalization that's happening on Twitter. But I think these are things we all need to be thinking about and willing to talk about and address rather than continuing to fracture and splinter. Because as Sunshiny said, we have to sort of, there has to be a cohesive organization to this, and that won't happen as we're sort of focusing on those splinter issues and falling apart.
I would love to even invite Sunshiny back on again in the future so we can have further dialogue on this. It's incredibly important because everything's intersectional right now.
Yeah, these and yeah, to sort of solidify that and follow up, like, these healthcare decisions are not being made in a silo. They're the result of many other decisions that are being made in all of the arenas that Sunshiny mentioned. And that is about our entire country, our entire population, all the different systems and how they're sort of intersecting with one another. So to effectively make those changes, it will have to be above and beyond healthcare.
And with that, we're going to sign off and say good night. Thank you, caring Canadians. We love you. Until next time.
Oh, thank you.